Shrink Wrap Radio number 466, Yoga Therapy for Addiction, Depression, and Anxiety with Sarah Joy Marsh.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Sarah Joy Marsh, certified yoga teacher and therapist in Portland, Oregon, and author of the 2015 book, Hunger, Hope, and Healing. For more information about Sarah Joy Marsh, please see our show notes on shrinkwrapradio.com. One of today's sponsors is Audible.com, who has more than 180,000 audiobooks and spoken audio products. Get a free audiobook of your choice at www.audibletrial.com/shrink. And before we go to the interview, I want to let all you professionals know that our strategic partner, the Jung Platform, has created CE courses from selected Shrink Wrap Radio interviews on topics such as dreams, relationships, synchronicity, trauma, and more. Go to www.jungplatform.com to see the latest courses. Now, here's today's interview. Sarah Joy Marsh, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, I'm delighted to have you. I'm curious about your first name, Sarah Joy, which is spelled as one word. Is that what it was at birth, or was that a later enhancement?
No, in fact, my name at birth was Jill, and that's still my first legal name. The name Sarah Joy came to me when I was leaving graduate school. I had graduated and was about to embark on a backpacking trip around the United States. Anonymously, nobody knew my name, and the name Sarah Joy came in a dream, and I thought, I'll use that.
Oh, wow. Wow, and a backpacking trip around the United States, that sounds like quite an adventure.
Well, this was 1992, where I picked up an All Aboard America pass on the Amtrak train, and I basically went off into the world to discover what it was about. My graduate studies were in art therapy and group dynamics. So okay. I have a master's in counseling, but my specialization was group dynamics and art therapy, and I wanted to see the world and see what groups looked like in different parts of the world. And I did that in the United States of America here.
Yeah, so were you actually stopping off then and going to different art therapy centers when you say you wanted to see how groups were working in other parts, or did you just mean human groups generally?
Right. I went to see human groups primarily looking at it in different alternative community settings. Uh-huh. For example, one of my stop-offs was on Orcas Island at a retreat center where people lived in intentional community for a time. And I got to be a part of that group and see what group dynamics were like there. And inevitably on the train, there's a small group of people traveling to a similar destination, and that's another dynamic. And in different campgrounds like Yosemite Valley in the summer, there was a resident staff for the summer, and they were a group, and they welcomed me into their group for a couple of weeks, and I got to experience it through that perspective too.
Wow, fascinating. So that you really were kind of like an itinerant researcher in a way.
I was, yeah.
Yeah, that's great. May I be so rude as to ask how old you were when you went off on this journey?
Yeah, that's not rude from my perspective.
Okay, good.
I went through my bachelor's and master's program as a combined program, and I left for this trip when I was 22, turning 23.
Okay. And where did you do that combined bachelor's and master's? I might have listeners who want to do something like that.
Well, I was at Lesley College. At the time, it was Lesley College. And since then, they've become Lesley University.
Is that in Boston?
It's in Boston, yeah. Actually, at Cambridge.
And okay.
I had gone first to the Art Institute of Boston, and then I went to Lesley College to study art therapy. And now it's called the Art Institute of Boston at Lesley University.
Uh-huh.
So I think my two alma maters have combined themselves. And I think that's very exciting.
Yeah, yeah. And what a rich background you have. And then you've we're going to be talking a lot about yoga and eating and your career around all of that. But before we get into that, I gather
this book, your book, which I should mention is titled Hunger, Hope, and Healing, A Yoga Approach to Reclaiming Your Relationship to Your Body and Food. I gather this grew out of your own story with food. Maybe you can share that with us here.
Yeah, it really did. In fact, that backpacking trip also grew out of my own experience with food and my recovery process. So prior to having any sense at all that I could recover, my life relationship to food was one of chronic restriction, more on the anorexic side of the spectrum, including compulsive exercise if I felt I'd eaten more than was quote-unquote suitable, or eaten foods that were considered bad foods or negative foods. And that alternated at a certain point with binging because my body was fundamentally starving. And in the animal sense of what that means, my brain couldn't tolerate that starvation, and I would end up binging on foods that were like quick sugar, carbs, things that I felt I was actually eating them, as I said, animalistically, like, and I couldn't stop.
Wow.
And then I would go back to compulsive exercising or restricting and so on.
So it's not that you were overweight then.
No. I mean, I perceived myself as being physically not the right weight.
Yeah.
At any weight, I perceived myself as being the wrong weight, that thinner was always going to be better.
Yeah, that's just, you know, since that's not something I've suffered from, it's always kind of amazing and a little bit difficult to comprehend.
Yeah, it's, you know, I can really feel it in my body still. The way that I experienced body-centered self-hatred that turned into the thought, there is something wrong with my body, it will never be right, it will always be too much. And I'm really an average body type. I have an athletic genetic makeup.
Yeah.
I'm not overweight. I wasn't overweight at the time, but my perception of myself was very distorted.
Yeah.
Although I can still feel that in my body, I don't live from that paradigm today.
That's interesting. So somewhere in your body or your brain, there's still something that says, that still nags at you in that way, saying that maybe it's wrong.
Well, thanks for clarifying with that question, because I don't have that storyline at all anymore. But what I can feel is the body memory of what that was like. And I can feel how painful that was. Now I have 25 years distance from that time in my life. But when I drop into it, the body memory builds my sense of compassion and empathy for any of my students or clients with whom I'm working today.
Yeah. Yeah. What role do you think advertising and media that kind of holds in front of women in particular, all of us, but more so in terms of women, an ideal body image, which is thin?
Yeah, I think the role of media and marketing is very influential and has been for generations, so that by the time my mother was born and her mother was born, there were images they had internalized. And therefore, my mother's narrative about her body, she verbalized to me without realizing she was doing it. Then I internalized that narrative, plus the narrative of our culture at the times. I was born in 1968, so there was a cultural change, but there was also a lot of focus still on thinness. And even today in the yoga community, as I watch advertising, much of it promotes a specific body type if you're going to be practicing or doing yoga, and which is a quandary for me as a yoga therapist and a counselor right now, that I do recommend people take up the practice of yoga because it was the catalyst of my own recovery. But often they feel like they're not permitted to join the community of people who do yoga because their body shape doesn't match what we see in the media.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, because I have come across yoga magazines, for example, as yoga has become sort of a lifestyle choice these days, you know, in the media. And I never thought about this before, but the photographs that they have in those magazines, I think, are all of fairly thin people.
They generally are. Yeah, they are.
Yeah. You write this. Go ahead.
There's also a certain age demographic, and or the way they represent aging in those magazines is relatively airbrushed and looks a lot more confident and secure than what I see when I help my students who've been aging and they don't see our culture reflecting what it is to be a female body that ages. Sometimes people's eating disorders, they rave up in adolescence and college. They might go away for a period of time, and then they come back in midlife as women are going through menopause and starting to look at, this is the aging process, and this is my hormone process. And they want to pick up the practice of yoga, but you look at the magazine, and the woman's reflection there, depending on the age that she is, it's very airbrushed and marketed. So that's another way that the dilemma shows up in our current advertising.
Yeah, I'm realizing you're totally right as I think about this and think about the images that I see in, not just in the magazines, but, for example, Target. Actually, yeah. I was surprised to see that they have a whole yoga section now. Whoever would have thought of that? But the images you talk about, they don't look like regular people. My wife wanted me to drive her to the mall to go shopping yesterday. There's an upscale mall that's kind of a ways away from where we live, and she didn't want to drive there. So I spent the day. I had nothing I wanted to shop for. So I just spent the day sitting around and staring at the passing crowd, you know. And so few people have, quotes, the ideal body type or ideal body shape.
Right, right. Very true. I spent most of yesterday in an airport because I was traveling back from the East Coast, and I do the same thing. I'm watching the human condition as it walks by, and it doesn't look radiant, healthy, vital, inspired, optimistic, or particularly thin.
Right, right. Yeah, sometimes I have to remind myself of that because I've internalized a lot of those same messages too, and I have to remind myself, you know, not to be overly self-critical about my body image. I'm an older adult male, and I look it, but still in my head, I've kind of got this younger version of myself. So sometimes it's a little shocking to look in the mirror.
Yeah, I understand that. I'm watching myself age. I'll be 47 next month, but I'm delighting in watching my skin change. And I say, wow, here's life experience. I have a very rich history in this body, and can I appreciate it? And also say, and this is what the body does as it ages. It's not betraying me. It's not telling me a lie. It's not out to get me. It's not against me. This is the body as it's aging. And when I cherish and appreciate that, I also am cherishing and appreciating my history in my body and whatever future I have, God willing, ahead of me.
Well, that's such a great way to frame it all. And I'm sure that's wonderful modeling for your students to the extent that you talk about that and share your journey with them. We don't really get any modeling like that. I'm not sure I've ever heard anybody say what you just said.
Well, I'm glad to offer it.
Now, you write that your journey started with suffering and was journey of suffering was then interrupted by awe. And I've not heard of awe in this context before. So maybe you can tell us about when you were first struck by awe and then what you see as the relationship between awe and healing.
Yeah, thank you. Well, I was suffering quite a bit with my body image and my eating issues and the constant sense that I couldn't get control over my life or myself or food or my body. And I had some blind instinct to go on a backpacking trip. This was way before I graduated from graduate school. I was going to go on this backpacking trip in the White Mountains of New Hampshire. I borrowed a backpack. I rented a car. I went to a trailhead. I did not know where I was going. In fact, I got lost on the way there. I started my hike up this relatively steep mountain with a backpack that weighed way too much for my physical frame to carry. I hadn't thought of trying the backpack on at home. I really was going pretty impulsively on this trip.
I'll say.
I didn't have any prior experience. I just had an instinct that I had to do this thing. And when I got to the top of that mountain, I had to put the backpack down because it was extraordinarily heavy. And you know, when you're hiking up, you've got to lean forward so the weight is really on your shoulders.
Yeah.
And at the top of the mountain, when I put the backpack down, I really literally had this revelation that I was unburdening myself, like laying down the baggage, the heaviness of what I'd been carrying for the many years that I was carrying my self-hatred and anxiety.
Wow.
And when I put that backpack down, I also lifted my gaze to look out at the view, and I was above treeline in New Hampshire, and it was extraordinarily beautiful, and you could see in every direction for miles. And I just had this one word arise. It was like, awe, there it is.
Yeah.
And I felt what I wanted in my life was more awe and less suffering. I wanted that peace and equanimity that I saw around me in nature and less of the sort of torture of my own mental thoughts. At that moment, I also decided my body was so sore and had felt so sort of demanded upon to make this hike up to the top of the mountain that I would start moving and stretching. And the way that I was doing that apparently became what we now know of as yoga. I didn't know at the time that there was a stretching practice called yoga, but I was doing this thing, stretching and relieving the tension in my body, and I felt a profound sense of personal peace that wasn't just intellectual or mental.
Yeah,
and I kept with that day after day. I just kept doing it.
Yeah, that's fascinating that you had not heard of yoga. I mean, it is so it has infiltrated our culture to such an extent that I'm surprised you hadn't heard of it. But it's wonderful that you kind of discovered it.
Well, this was 1989, and yoga was still in the basement of the food co-op. I mean, there weren't really big yoga studios. It wasn't so widely marketed. I don't know if there was a yoga clothing company at that time. And I was relatively poor. I was a graduate student, and I didn't have the funds to think of going to a yoga class or even buying a health club membership. And I didn't feel like I belonged in a health club either because I was so, quote unquote, unhealthy or undesirable in my physical body. I felt like I shouldn't join a health club because other people were healthy in there. So I didn't have any exposure to it myself. It may have existed in the community that I lived in. I was in Harvard Square, but I didn't know of it myself.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Because I was into yoga during that period, but I was in California. But actually, I started out in Michigan, and it would have been the mid-60s, so, and I was exposed to yoga initially in a YMCA program.
And, oh, that's great.
Yeah, in the mid-60s. So that's, you know, that's kind of my history with that. And I'm also impressed, though, by in retrospect, when you did discover yoga, you found that, hey, this is something that my body kind of directed me toward on its own. And it turns out, you know, it's existed for a long time. I had a similar experience of having aches and pains in my body, and I would find myself pressing on certain places in my body with my thumbs, and these places seem to move around over the years, places that kind of were achy and hurt. And what I later discovered was that the places I was pressing on were acupuncture points.
Mm.
And so that to me lent a kind of validity to the whole idea of acupuncture, that I was sort of discovering their importance independently, just as you did with yoga.
Yeah, that's quite remarkable. And it reminds me that when I'm talking with my students, and I mentioned this also in my book, that there is an underlying body intelligence in each of us.
Mm-hmm.
It wants to care for us. It wants to nurture our health and vitality, and it wants to support us to thrive. However, most of us don't have a relationship with that body intelligence because we're also trained in our culture to go on will, to decide how we're going to treat the body and what we're going to do to it and how we're going to be in it. And we can actually override that body intelligence with sheer force of will.
Yes.
So I appreciate that when I'm teaching yoga to people, and I see also, yes, with acupuncture and Tai Chi and Qigong, that we can help somebody awaken their relationship to underlying body intelligence and learn how to partner with it. whether they're going to be a top athlete or a mother of young children, if we can partner with our body intelligence, it's going to thrive on our behalf.
Yes.
I was definitely not doing that when I was restricting calories and trying new diets and imposing rigid standards on myself. My body intelligence and I did not know each other at that time.
That's a great way to put it. Well, let's talk about eating disorders a bit more. One of the things you talk about is hunger, and that we've lost touch with our satiation response. How so?
Well, there's different kinds of hunger, and the hunger for food is a hunger for nourishment, and a hunger based on that body intelligence, a hunger for nourishing the brain, not just the physical body, but nourishing the systems that operate on behalf of our vitality. And those systems don't need us to overfeed them, nor do they benefit well when we underfeed or misfeed them. And so what most of us experience as hunger might actually feel like craving first, like craving for certain kinds of food, and then we use that craving to fill the spot that would be called hunger. I like to reorganize that so that somebody can feel the hunger their body has and for what kind of nourishment, say physically, nutritionally, even with hydration, what is the hunger actually for? And when we start listening in that way, we can ask the question on a scale of 1 to 10, for example, how hungry am I? And is it for food? Is it for hydration? Is it for movement? And then as we're eating, for example, now how satiated am I? Was this enough? Am I now being driven by mouth hunger, which is for flavor? Or did I satisfy my stomach hunger and my brain hunger? The brain needs nutrients too. And is it time to stop eating this really delicious meal? Or do I have to finish everything on my plate because I paid for it at the restaurant? So my suggestion to students is to relate to it as the nourishment the body and brain need. And when that's happening, our system works a lot better and we have access to the other hungers, which are like hungers for adventure, hungers for spontaneity or creativity, or the hunger for solace or refuge, or the hunger for unique expression artistically. When those hungers don't get heard, our lives become more dull and robotic and frenzied.
Yeah, I really was interested in that part. I like the way that you spelled out those other kinds of hunger that we don't necessarily conceptualize in that way. So, but it seems like there's this kind of metaphorical but real relationship between our emotional hungers, our emotional needs, and our physical needs. And I guess that shouldn't be too surprising since it's one body, it's one system.
Right. Let's say somebody feels restless, physically restless. What if that restlessness isn't actually asking for food? It's a sign that something in our life is a little out of balance and something wants to emerge but doesn't have room to do so. So we experience physical restlessness, which we might misinterpret as agitation, and we might decide that some sort of numbing food event is going to help us dampen that down. We just missed an opportunity to find out if restless was actually an instinct trying to emerge to give direction to our lives. That accumulated over time becomes anxiety and depression.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, speaking about the sort of metaphorical sense of hunger, you tell a story about Mother Teresa that I had heard elsewhere, but maybe you can share that here.
Yeah, it's in the first part of my book there.
Yeah.
That when Mother Teresa opened up a center in the Bay Area, somebody asked her, well, why are you helping people here when we seem to have such an abundance of food? And across the world in India, where she had centers, of course, people did face issues with poverty and hunger. And she responded by saying, well, there are hungers for ordinary bread, and there are hungers for other things in life, and we actually seem to be relatively starving here in America. And this was, of course, decades ago, but look at our circumstances haven't changed that much, and in some ways have been escalated by the internet rage and the social media rage. Like, people are hungry to have somebody else's life other than their own. When they look at Facebook or they look at social media and think, oh, that person's life looks so interesting and mine's not. Of course, we just see a slice of somebody else's life in that regard. And the hunger pains we feel might better be used to say, am I living the life I want to be living?
Yeah.
Rather than asking, how could I live that person's life?
And the slice that we see is the slice that they want us to see, too. And so they're not likely to show the pain that they're struggling with.
Right. Yeah.
And I seem to recall, too, that one of the things that Mother Teresa identified is that people here were suffering from loneliness. She said this was the kind of the loneliest place that she had encountered. And I think that's also echoed in the social media that you were just talking about, that we're kind of, we're trying to fill that loneliness, I think, through social media. I don't know how successful they are. I know that when I'm feeling down, it doesn't occur to me to get on my computer and reach out to people. Somehow that just feels like it's not going to work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And actually, I do address the concept of loneliness in my book. And one of the things I'd like to say about it, in case listeners who experience loneliness might find this helpful, in the book, as you know, I teach four essential life skills. And one of them is called moving from love, not shame. And my experience of people who've internalized shame as their very essence, which I had done, experience a profound sense of isolation, which then also feels like loneliness. But that isolation that I experienced when I was in my disordered eating years, that was very painful because I looked around me and I didn't see that other people experienced loneliness or isolation. They seemed to have it together. And so one of the things I do in the life skill called moving from love, not shame, is I teach people how to actively end the feeling of isolation and develop an interconnected sense of themselves, even if that interconnected relationship is first with nature or first with their own body and its body intelligence, but inevitably to have a sense of interconnection with humans here and everywhere.
So say a little bit more about that, about how you do that. As I think about it, shame is very inner-directed. It's like I'm focused on myself exclusively. And so it sounds like by directing people towards love, it's also a call to move away from the total focus on oneself to some kind of moving out towards others, sharing with others.
Yeah, so from the perspective of yoga, we are born as this word. This is a Sanskrit word. I hope it's okay for your listeners. We're born as ananda, which means born as luminosity or contentment or joy or love. And we're born as that, and we could express that if we didn't get distracted by, clouded in by, or confused about who we are. And that fundamental confusion that is shame blocks our ability to remember that we were born worthy of love and belonging.
Mm-hmm.
So that once that's happened, a couple of the first steps that I do with my students, one is to educate them about how shame gets internalized, what its purpose might have been, how it went awry, and how it's no longer and wasn't at the time telling you the truth. Shame isn't motivating, but a lot of us have tried to use shame to motivate towards a diet or athletic pursuit or even a career. So I first do education about this is shame, this is how it happened, this is what it's doing to your life, this is how it's unhelpful. And then here's love, here's kindness, here's acceptance of yourself. And what does that do to your biochemistry and your physiology that then promotes your actual ability to grow?
Okay, the nervous system, so really self-love, self-acceptance.
So the first thing is to look at, can I internalize a relationship of self-acceptance, self-love, self-worth, so that my nervous system stops broadcasting so often that I'm anxious and about to be threatened by that shame voice again? Because that shame voice puts your nervous system into fight, flight, freeze, or submit reactions against life and against yourself. The relationship of love and kindness towards oneself actually alters the nervous system towards capacity. Now, since shame is isolating, the next thing I tell students to practice is create a gesture of kindness towards another human being, even if they don't know you're doing it. Like, let somebody else into traffic, or acknowledge the postman when they come with the mail, or when you're out in the world and you see somebody who seems relatively anonymous, you can say to them, may you be free from unnecessary suffering and experience peace and joy. And that well wish to an anonymous other actually builds your interpersonal brain and builds the nervous system towards what's now called the ventral vagal parasympathetic response to life.
Good for you.
What's that?
Good for you getting that sentence out. And I'm impressed that you're keeping up to date with that literature, with the neuroscience literature. I've been interviewing people about those topics as well, and I'm really impressed by how fluent you are as you're speaking about your approach. And it's clear that you have, not only are you doing yoga and incorporating that with Buddhist philosophy, but also with your training in as a counselor, it sounds like.
Yeah, I really enjoy weaving those things together. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So you said there were four, the shame-love continuum was the first of four.
So there are four essential life skills. And actually the first one, because a lot of us are struggling, before we can even talk about shame, the brain is going to reject that because of the neurobiology of shame. I mean, it's very likely that the brain is already frightened, overwhelmed. The biochemistry has a set point that isn't that friendly. So the first life skill is actually called getting in the gap. And by that I mean getting grounded. That's what the G stands for. Paying attention and becoming present. So this is like mindfulness practice. And I like to say getting grounded. Choose what you're going to be mindfully tuning into. Then pay attention and do it again. And pay attention again until you're actually training your mind and therefore your brain to become present, mm-hmm. where your biochemistry can accept life as it is in the moment without feeling that you're about to be under threat. So that's the first skill I want to teach someone. And we do it in the body and with the breath, because bringing those systems together more quickly changes the brain state. And so I'll just say a little bit on the science of that, because people don't understand when I say the breath and the body can change the brain state. Well, for example, the diaphragm and the brain are always toggling back and forth, communicating in very rapid fire messages with each other. So if the diaphragm can become your go-to breathing muscle, which means lessening belly tension, softening the skin of the body, and releasing the apprehension about breathing, once that happens, the brain chemistry says, oh, we aren't under siege right now. We could risk being present to the here and now, to this moment. So if I suggest it only cognitively, I don't get as much traction as if I help somebody come back to their diaphragmatic breathing and their body-centered movement practice, which we call yoga. Once I've got traction on that, then I can teach the student the next life skill, which people often have a little wrinkle about. It's called getting comfortable feeling uncomfortable. And my students say, well, I've already been uncomfortable. I've been profoundly uncomfortable. And I say, yeah, well, you learn to tolerate that kind of discomfort. But I need to help you tolerate the discomfort of growing and evolving. Not just the discomfort of continuing to self-harm, but the discomfort that lasts just long enough that you realize you've outlived the discomfort without having to binge or purge or hate yourself. And the next level of discomfort is the discomfort of celebrating that. So those are discomforts to kind of celebrate, as I said, because they're building your capacity.
Yeah.
Now I can start having the conversation about shame, because a shame conversation is pretty uncomfortable if you haven't had other tools to practice yet. So that's why moving from love, not shame, is the third life skill we talk about.
I see. And the one that you were just talking about, getting comfortable with your discomfort, is that's also kind of practiced or echoed in the body, I would imagine, as one is doing stretches that are not entirely comfortable.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So you're doing it at two levels, is what I'm noticing.
We are, yeah. And I teach people how to navigate the discomfort in the body with stretching, so that we're practicing that in real time. When they're in my physical presence and I'm in theirs, my sense of confidence in their body intelligence is great. and they start feeling sensation that's uncomfortable. And because our two brains are wired together, as we all now know, my empathy for their circumstance builds their capacity to accept the sensation and think of it as, here's a chance for me to grow my bandwidth in life. Then they can translate it from body sensation to emotional sensation and start practicing getting comfortable feeling uncomfortable as a way to navigate emotions towards greater joy and love and self-acceptance.
Yeah. Now, do you share with me the belief that the goal is not so much to be able to get into a certain pose as it is the process of growing into that pose, if one can do it or not? Because if it was all about being able to twist your body like a pretzel, then circus performers would all be enlightened beings.
Right. And ballet dancers wouldn't have eating disorders. I'm not singling them out. I just said that because I do have some students who are ballet dancers. I was a gymnast. That was probably fed into some of my eating issues and body issues. But if you think about it, it's that the process of the yoga is more important than whether or not you're doing yoga. Because I can see my students, and I myself was tempted at times to go to yoga to burn calories, change the shape of the body, have more control over the body, and try to make it do what I wanted it to do. And that actually isn't a yogic approach. So, and my training as an art therapist was in what we call process-oriented art therapy.
Yes.
And my training as a yoga therapist is, we could call that process-oriented yoga therapy.
Yeah, I'm hearing that. I'm hearing that. So what's the fourth major thing that you teach?
Yeah, the fourth life skill, it's called personal buoyancy. And personal buoyancy, like, you know, when something's buoyant on the ocean, it doesn't sink as much.
Oh, buoyancy, yes.
Personal buoyancy, which is related to today's conversations about resilience and vagal tone.
Mm-hmm.
So we're all born with a certain amount of vagal tone or a certain baseline for our resilience that can either be supported and further developed, or it can get interrupted and compromised. Most of my students had their resilience or their personal buoyancy compromised, often by trauma or neglectful or misattuned environments. So by the time they come to see me, their sense of buoyancy is actually pretty collapsible. What that means is they make a decision in the morning, they're not going to eat a certain food that day, or they're going to outlive their painful behaviors. And by 10 o'clock, they're already doing the behavior. So they collapsed under their own leadership again and again. Well, they don't realize that part of that is that they weren't personally buoyant enough to make a decision and follow through on it. Sometimes that means that we're not hydrated, or we don't have enough sleep. We don't have enough physiological equanimity. So the body's actually anxious, and so is the brain. And I teach people how to regain that resilience in their physical body. That's what we refer to as personal buoyancy.
Yeah. Now, in addition to these four life skills, you also talk about that we need to lead a 360-degree life. Maybe you can tell us about that.
Yeah. Yeah. I like to say we have the privilege of doing that, because we do have this human brain, and we have generations of humans before us, and we can learn from them. And we also, of course, our lives go downstream to our children and our children's children and our communities. So we have the honor and the privilege of leading a 360-degree life. And that means we get to live the full spectrum of what it is to be human. However, most people don't. We live a 40 to 50-degree life, like a small slice of that, which is to say what I permit myself to express or experience, what I feel is okay to think or feel. And when I've experienced myself and my students who have disordered eating patterns, that is getting more confined, not more expansive. So as we start expanding somebody's life from, let's say, 40 to 360, we actually go from 40 to 50 to 60. We go slowly. As you're doing that process, what you start encompassing is feeling yourself as a part of the human condition that has both physiological imperatives and spiritual capacities, and needs us to know how to experience sorrow, compassion, elation, joy, grief, tenderness, loving kindness. There's such an enormous spectrum of what we can experience as a human without having to make ourselves bad or wrong about it. When we start allowing that to happen, we live that more 360 life and less confined to our perceptions of what's acceptable or unacceptable.
Okay. Coming back to the eating disorder, explain binge eating disorder.
Well, binge eating is the sense of urgency coupled with the pace with which you're eating a certain amount of food. So it's like a large quantity in a short amount of time and a sense of urgency about doing it. Generally, my experience is we're trying to affect the physiology in the body in some way to get relief. We might experience it as getting numb or feeling like suddenly lethargic and dull, and at least we're not so anxious. So binge eating is an effort to self-medicate, as I see it, and it's generally built as a survival strategy early in life. We go to food, it works. We go to food again, it works. We do it again, it works. We start escalating our reliance on food. The episodes might get bigger, faster, and quicker, and they might start happening closer together. That's when it's escalating. Some people might binge once a week. It's still a binge eating disorder as we go to relying on a behavior that actually feels more painful than helpful in hindsight.
And do you relate, you talk about food in the context of addiction as well. And are there other kinds of addictions that end up coming to your program?
Yes, I also work with people struggling with alcohol and drug addiction. We actually have a separate program for the disordered eating students, partly because some people, there's a lot more media exposure and maybe more understanding these days of alcohol and drug addiction. There's still judgment, of course. But when I combine groups, if you have a disordered eating pattern and you have a certain sense that that's really like radically unacceptable, to be in a group that's focused on that feels safer and easier to talk about, and the behaviors don't seem so bizarre because other people also have behaviors that you can empathize or have compassion for. But I do work with drug and alcohol rehab in a separate program, and we also work with people who have cutting behaviors. Usually that's in my private practice that I'm seeing someone who's not just binge eating but also cutting. Do you, you know what cutting is, I'm guessing?
Oh, yes. Okay. Yeah. Tends to be young people, right? Who young women, as far as I know, who cut themselves with razor blades and so on.
Yeah, I've seen it in both genders these days. Uh-huh. And sometimes it's the one behavior that a person can keep behind the scenes for years and years. So it might start when they're young, but I've seen it go on for decades. By the time somebody comes to see me, they've been using that behavior. And now they're asking, can yoga help relieve this particular reliance on that behavior?
Well, how do people find you?
We have a website. It's sarahjoyyoga.com. That's an introduction to my professional practice as a yoga therapist.
And yeah, but I meant sort of more generally than how will listeners find you. I meant these days, how do these people who are suffering and in pain, I mean, most people, the first thing that comes to mind is not yoga for most people who are, you know, suffering from addiction or food problems.
And that's one reason that I wrote the book was I'm hoping to give people something in their hands they can consider as an option. And in the book, my aim was to write it with a voice of empathy so the listener or reader could feel like I really get them. And then they might consider the practice of yoga as a new tool.
Yeah.
Here in Portland, how people find me is usually word of mouth, or their nutritionist, their naturopath, or their therapist refers them to me.
Uh-huh. Okay. Okay, yeah. Because it with all the yoga that's out there, you know, with so many varieties, and what you're doing is almost 180 degrees maybe from some other approaches to yoga, which are more like going to boot camp.
Right. Yeah, it's true. And that's why I actually have a handout. I'll send it to you. When professionals want to refer a student to a yoga class or a client to a yoga program, there are some questions they should be asking about the yoga program or the yoga teacher before they refer. Because yoga shows up in a lot of different ways right now, and some of those could be pretty unhelpful or could reinforce body-centered self-hatred or compulsive exercise.
Yeah, you, since we're talking about four life skills and 360-degree living, one of the things you write about are the three stages of recovery. What are the three stages of recovery?
Yeah, the first stage, as I see it, is helping, it's called tapas in Sanskrit. It's helping someone to relearn the art of self-nurturing discipline. The word tapas in Sanskrit actually means discipline, and people can take that to be punitive or recriminatory or rigid. So I frame it as the discipline required to nurture yourself in the fundamentals, and those fundamentals also increase your personal buoyancy, and they help to balance your brain chemistry enough for the second stage of recovery. Those fundamentals include things like, can I be disciplined enough today to hydrate myself? A lot of our health problems actually are about dehydration, but people don't know it. So I often give that as my first recommendation. Before a food recommendation, I'm saying, are you hydrated? And let's look at your relationship to self-care by committing to hydrating every day for the next week. Come back and tell me how that went, and then we'll know your relationship to caring for yourself. We'll have that fleshed out a bit more.
Well, how much water does one need to drink in order to be hydrated?
Yeah, depending on whether they're taking any pharmaceutical medications or drinking coffee or alcohol and so on, there's different ways to measure that. But the basic is about 50% of your body weight in ounces in water. And that means if you weigh 100 pounds, you're having 50 ounces of water in the course of a day. Not all at once in the first half hour of the morning, because you can't hydrate that way, but you have it incrementally throughout the course of the day. And when I tell my students this, I want them to sip their water and say to themselves, I'm right now caring for myself. I am right now caring for my well-being, my brain and my body, which is different than the chatter we have as we're binge eating or saying, oh, I'm really fucking this up again. So that stage of recovery is to learn how to care enough to be kinder to the body and more nourishing. Then I can take the student to the next stage of recovery, which requires that more stable brain chemistry and a more hopeful inlook and outlook. And that's called svadhyaya, which means to study yourself, to inquire about your behaviors and your mind states and your emotions, but to really do so through the lens of self-empathy, like to look at yourself as someone having the human experience and to understand that all of our behaviors arise for valid needs, and all of our moods and emotions arise out of valid purposes in the body. So we don't have to keep making them bad or wrong, but rather a place of inquiry and curiosity. That's the second stage of recovery, and it's a really rich stage of recovery because people start to realize first that they haven't been flawed, they never were flawed or broken, they haven't been actually all that alone. They're more connected to humanity than they realize, and that what they're experiencing can be celebrated rather than damned, as it were, or judged. And the third stage of recovery in yoga is called Ishvari Pranidhana. It means surrender. And I translate it as the stage of recovery in which we experience forgiveness and freedom. And that means forgiving ourselves for the pain that we've been in or the pain we've caused others by our behaviors. It brings us back to love and the freedom then to keep experiencing ourselves as a person growing and evolving, and the freedom from behaviors that were once rigid and painful, the freedom to live a vital and 360-degree life.
Okay. You also have something you describe as one-minute dashboarding activities that boost resilience. What do you mean dashboarding? And maybe you can give us some of those.
Yeah. I have a concept in the book under personal buoyancy. It's called your body dashboard. Much like your car, you actually have a dashboard for the body. I have illustrations that I give students for that, so it looks like a dashboard. But on that body dashboard, there are seven essentials for daily well-being. And these are based on your body's intelligence, the underlying operating system. One is hydration, which I mentioned a moment ago. Let's say a body dashboard one-minute intervention is to ask yourself the question, have I experienced nature today? Have I experienced the air against my skin or the sun through the window? Have I taken a look around me to see that I belong to this incredible majesty called nature? And if I haven't, can I get up and go outside for a few moments? Can I refresh my brain and my relationship to the natural world? Another one might be, have I today balanced my blood sugar? Have I honored that fundamental need in my body? If I haven't done that, what can I do now to bring blood sugar balance to my system? Do I need protein? Am I thirsty? How's my brain working? Can I care enough about that? And can I take a small action step in that direction? And each of those questions I recommend to the student, they reflect for the question about a minute and take action within that minute. So it's a quick, like I said, intervention in that regard.
Yeah, fascinating. Fascinating. So what's a... I'm imagining that you have sort of maybe two main kinds of activities, classes on the one hand and individual sessions on the other. What do your classes look like?
Yeah, the classes I do for Hunger, Hope, and Healing are like small group therapy sessions. Mm-hmm. Because my background is in counseling and group dynamics, I really enjoy working in the group process. I also find that
About how many students?
I limit it to 12 students for group therapy.
Yeah, good.
Yeah. So we can really build a relationship from student to student. The shame lessens, the empathy increases, the courage in the room goes up exponentially. But if the group gets too big, people can feel a little bit lost in that. So my maximum size is 12 for group therapy at home.
Do you require a certain level of commitment in terms of how many sessions or what length of time they're going to come?
Yeah, the basic series is 8 weeks long, and sometimes, like during the holidays, we don't get 8 weeks, we only get four, but I ask people to commit to those 4 weeks and to commit to each other as well as themselves.
Yeah, okay. And then tell us more about the structure of a class session. How long does it go, and how do you divide it up?
Yeah, the group therapy sessions are 2 hours once a week for the duration of the weeks that we have. We include a psychoeducational component that I'm presenting on. It's usually related to something from the book or a question that's come out of the group process. And then we have individual check-ins, and that's where students see and feel and hear my response to other women, which is often a place of courage building, because a woman sees me respond to the other woman's check-in and gets a sense of her own capacity out of watching that dynamic. So I really appreciate that process. And then we have yoga, breathing, and restorative poses at the end of class.
And so are you working only with women?
In these group sessions, I'm working only with women right now. Uh-huh. I haven't had enough requests from men. I would certainly do a men's group. My minimum group size is 6 because I find that builds enough container to do the work. So if I had 6 men committed to the group, I would certainly do it.
Uh-huh. And I see that you've created 2 foundations. Maybe you can tell us about those.
Yeah, my first nonprofit is called Living Yoga, and I started that in 1998, teaching yoga in prisons and rehab centers and for homeless youth. So that was like my instinct to go hiking back in 1989.
Yeah.
This was also an instinct. To bring yoga into prison settings, that was my first institutional destination. Then I went to rehab centers and then to shelters for homeless youth. And then in 2012, I started another nonprofit called the Daya Foundation. That's our Portland-based yoga therapy studio. And we provide programs in-house for people with medical sensitivities, such as Parkinson's, multiple sclerosis, spinal cord injuries, as well as anxiety, depression, addiction, and PTSD. We do outreach in hospitals and school settings, and we work with the officers in the prison system now. And one nonprofit serves the inmates, the other nonprofit is serving the officers.
Now, I hear you say, using the word we, Do you have advanced students who, you know, who have graduated to the role of being co-teachers?
We have other yoga therapists. So I've trained yoga therapists, including clinical psychologists who become yoga therapists as well as clinical psychologists. I train social workers in the work of yoga therapy, and I've trained yoga teachers to become yoga therapists. So it's really a team of people serving in this way. We also have a board of directors and a staff. So when I say we, I mean everyone's contribution to making that happen.
Yeah. Now, the term yoga therapy, I think maybe I've heard that term before. Is there a movement that is emerging that's called the yoga therapy?
Yeah, and the yoga therapy field is trying to define itself before it gets defined by another field.
Uh-huh.
So
yeah.
One of our organizations here in the U.S. is called the International Association of Yoga Therapists, and I'm a part of that organization, and we're trying to define yoga therapy as a viable field that looks at holistic practice, incorporating the psychology, philosophy, and physiology of yoga into healing.
Well, that's fascinating, and that strikes me as a good idea to the extent that because it sounds like what you're doing is really important work and is distinctive enough that it deserves its own recognition.
Yeah, that's the foundation for why we're taking action in this area, and I'm trying to help make the language culture change, where I say to people, I'm a yoga therapist and a yoga teacher.
Yeah.
Because there are two different things. When I teach my weekly classes at the yoga studio, I'm acting as a yoga teacher. I can't take away the lens of my mental health background or my yoga psychology background, but I'm working as a yoga teacher in the classroom, and I might have 40 or 50 students in that room. I'm teaching it therapeutically, but I'm acting as a yoga teacher.
Yeah.
And in my yoga therapy practice, I'm wearing my mental health hat, my spiritual compassionate guide hat, and my yoga psychology hat, too.
A lot of hats.
Well, fortunately, they're all connected.
Yeah, you do a good job of blending them. Well, as we begin to wind down here, I wonder if there are other things that you'd like to add, maybe that my questions haven't evoked.
Well, I would just say in the same vein as the field of yoga therapy is growing and expanding, that what I love to do as a professional in training settings is teaching clinicians such as yourself or someone else who's working in private practice, mm-hmm. and they want to integrate pieces of yoga therapy into their existing practice. So our training is actually approved by the American Psychological Association, which is the only one of its kind here in the U.S. right now. And we teach clinicians and therapists and social workers how to bring elements of yoga therapy into their main practice, which might be a dialogue practice, like a traditional therapy relationship. And I find that very exciting because it starts introducing yoga therapy in settings in which it otherwise wouldn't happen. So that's one thing I would like to highlight from our conversation today.
Yeah. Now, when you say that your approach is approved by the American Psychological Association, I'm not quite sure what has been approved by who. Can you say a little bit
yeah,
more about
so
that?
So we teach a yoga therapy training that is 300 hours of study. The first 160 hours of study is more of the physiological, physically based yoga practices. And the second 140 hours is the psychology of yoga, including mindfulness, interpersonal neurobiology, the physiology of breathing, and using the entire pantheon of the psychology of yoga in that training. Those 140 hours are approved of for CE credits by the American Psychological Association.
Okay. And so do you travel around the country doing this, or do people travel to Portland to...
Right now people travel to Portland. We teach it in weekend modules, and there's 8 weekends over the course of 8 months. Those weekends are intensives. It's 14 hours each weekend. And then we have a final 4-day immersion where people come together, and it's 30 hours of study in 4 days. So that's relatively intensive also. We want it to be travel friendly for people to come here.
Sure.
Because I can't travel any more than I'm already doing for my other work.
Sure. Is this program, is the training program described on your website?
It is, yeah.
Because I think we might have listeners who would be interested in getting that kind of training. And so,
yeah, it's our yoga therapy training, and it's called the Part 2 training because it's the second 140 hours of training that we do.
Yeah. And what is your website address again?
It's sarahjoyyoga.com, which has two Y's in the middle, sarahjoyyoga.com.
Okay. Well, Sarah Joy, it's been a delight to speak with you, and I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Oh, you're absolutely welcome. It's been delightful for me, too.
Well, clearly Sarah Joy Marsh is no ordinary yoga teacher. I'm persuaded by this interview that a separate interdisciplinary field of yoga therapy actually makes sense. I'm so impressed by her fluency in speaking about her work and her command of the latest neuroscience findings as they relate to that work. She clearly is keeping up. You heard her mention that she would send me a flyer that she's created to help people find a yoga teacher with whom healing might occur. I'm sure she won't mind my reading those guidelines here. For example, she raises the question, active versus passive. Active language supports students in reclaiming how they move their body. Passive doesn't lend itself to as much personal leadership and is often inaccurate. An example of active. As you inhale, raise your arms over your head. I invite you to feel into your own end range for this and to ask, where is your body breathing just now? And it's an example of passive, she says. As you inhale, allow your arms to float up overhead, which arms can't do on their own. Gravity pulls them down. Feel your breath lifting your arms, but the breath supports this action. But this phrase is one step removed from ownership, she says. She goes on to ask, does the teacher value and make use of imagery as well as linear instructions? Imagery asks the right brain mode to participate. Linear language asks the left mode to participate. For example, press into your index finger knuckles, and as you energize your arms, turn your triceps in towards your nose. This broadens the back of your heart and creates strong river banks through which your heart can flow downstream. I invite you to release any unnecessary tension in your heart and to send it downstream for now. The pace of language is also important, she notes. Does the teacher talk at a pace that allows students to take in the information? Does she or he consider the brain processing speed of someone entering or navigating recovery? Voice prosody, prosody, it's not a word I use very much. Is their voice tone warm and empathetic? Focus on inner experience or outer form? Does the teacher emphasize the inner experience of each pose or attaining the outer form? Structural safety in yoga poses. Does the teacher understand how to create safe, stable, non-injurious yoga poses? Are they educated about osteoporosis, hypermobile joints, trauma, anxiety, etc.? Are mindfulness and breathing tools woven in? Does the teacher provide takeaway tools for the student to use when not in class? Do teachers have knowledge of nervous system regulation, vagus nerve, diaphragm, enteric nervous system? The teacher's knowledge of value of proximity, not just participation. Will they allow a student to simply be in the room, even if lying down? Do they understand that proximity with safety and empathy can evolve into participation? The teacher's personal body image and language about self. How does the teacher talk about or refer to themselves and their personal body image? So these are the guidelines that she provided, and maybe they will be useful to you in finding your own personal yoga teacher. Once again, Sarah Joy's website is www.sarahjoyyoga.com. So again, the title of her book is Hunger, Hope, and Healing, A Yoga Approach to Reclaiming Your Relationship to Your Body and Food. As always, you're encouraged to purchase this book using the Amazon widget in the right-hand sidebar at shrinkwrapradio.com. And actually, I'll be running an ad for her book in the right-hand sidebar, and you can just click on that.
Greetings, Dr. Dave. This is Jennifer Walrod calling you from Missoula, Montana. I'm a practicing psychotherapist in Missoula and also teach at the University of Montana, your old stomping ground, I understand. Today, I wanted to call and thank you for all your efforts and work to bring us Shrink Wrap Radio. The ways that I have benefited personally from your podcast are more than I can count or will count in this short voicemail. But because of that, I made what I plan as the first of many monetary contributions to you in the hopes to support and encourage your work, as it has been so meaningful to me. So just a quick message of thanks to you, Dr. Dave, and many blessings to you and your work.
Thank you, Jennifer, there in Missoula. How great that someone who teaches at the University of Montana, where I got my master's degree, listens to Shrink Wrap Radio. It feels like some sort of circle is completed. Well, I hope others will join Jennifer in supporting this labor of love, if you have not already done so, that is. Now, here are some new additions to our honor roll of donors. A big thanks goes out to Sylvie Berut, Katie Hall, Rami Nymanen, Nicholas Litersky, Jim and Colleen Lowry, and Bjorn Thanell. And I apologize for any mispronunciations there. Some of those thanks were overdue. Actually, the money was contributed some time back, and I only just discovered it. So thanks to all of you. No new transcripts to announce just now. By the way, I put a new listener survey on the site, and it would be really helpful if you take a minute or two to fill it out. There are only 12 questions. The old survey had a lot more than that and was created nearly 10 years ago. So I needed to update my understanding of my audience. So just go to the survey tab on our site. And once again, we have a new affiliate sponsor. It's DreamHost. I know some of you must be thinking about having a website or starting a podcast. You can get one free domain name registration for a year by clicking on the blinking DreamHost banner in our left-hand sidebar and then using my special discount code of ShrinkWrap on signout. Now, if you're searching for a new career or looking to upgrade the career you're already in, let me refer you to another banner ad in our left-hand sidebar for our sponsor, Ed4 Online. They provide courses in four distinct areas of online education, including career training, personal enrichment, professional development, and health and human services. Their curriculum is designed based on best practices, allowing individuals to gain knowledge and experience in a variety of core competencies. They offer core materials, videos, website resources, quizzes, and reference materials as part of their online teaching experience. And I might add that whole thing was designed and run by a psychologist. Finally, for any of you who are not already members of Audible.com, my favorite audiobook service, Sarah Joy's book is not available there, but an abridged version of the classic work Light on Life, The Yoga Journey to Wholeness, Inner Peace, and Ultimate Freedom by BKS Iyengar is. You'll get 5 hours of yogic wisdom. So if you're not already an Audible.com subscriber, you can get this audiobook for free and to keep with no obligation to continue your subscription by going to audibletrial.com/shrink. And of course, if that's not to your taste, they have 180 other titles for you to choose from.
Hi, this is Dr. David Feinstein, psychologist, energy therapist, and author, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Dr. David Feinstein, who was my guest back on Shrink Wrap Radio, episode number 333, on developments in energy therapy. Now let's take a quick dip into the old email bag, and I'll read just one, and it's from Mahyar at the University of Tehran. I'm very excited to have listeners there, and especially on the brink of signing historic accords between our two countries. I had asked Mahyar, who's been a longtime listener and frequent correspondent, to tell me a bit about herself. And so she writes, "Dear Dr. Dave, I'm happy to see that you care to take note of listener suggestions, and as I came to know you, this does not surprise me. I'm also glad that you care to know more about me. I'm 23, not married, no children. I'm now working on my dissertation for a master's degree. My topic would be on Philip Zimbardo's time perspective theory and its potential relations with some personality constructs concerning mindfulness and self-knowledge, as I think any psychological function has something to do with time perspective as far as it's embedded in time, which I think is always the case. I work for some publishing houses for a living and spend the rest of my time in a library reading what I like. And that's the best part of my day," she says with an exclamation point. "I'm also in analysis," and that has three exclamation points, 2 days a week. "It's made me interested to know as much as I can about how the mind works. Shrink Wrap Radio also has been one of the most important sources of inspiration for some long time. It helps me be connected with international frontiers of psychology and mental health in general, and it does so in a unique fashion. No doubt, reading provides great material, but listening to your interviews has a different taste as it allows an intimate and firsthand encounter that's hard to grasp in pages. And I'd very much like to thank you for that. By the way, as I've heard thought-provoking interviews with outstanding Jungian analysts on Shrink Wrap Radio, I wanted to ask if you've probably read Titus Buckhart's Mirror of the Intellect, Essays on the Traditional Science and Sacred Art. The longest chapter examines and criticizes Jung's stance about spirituality and the intellect from a perennial philosopher's view. René Guénon does the same for psychoanalysis, and again, mostly Jung in his book The Reign of Quantity and the Signs of the Times. Don't know if it fits with your schedule for interviews, but given that you had an interview about Meister Eckhart and many more about Jung and Jungian perspective, I thought maybe an interview examining such approaches, which mostly are critics of psychoanalysis, would be valuable and surely very interesting to listen to for myself, specifically if approached by psychoanalysts themselves." And then she went on to give me links on Amazon to books by the authors that she mentioned. And she concludes, "I thank you again, and I'm sorry to have written so long a letter. Always yours, Mahyar." So, Mahyar, I really appreciated that extra background on you. Having corresponded so much, I was beginning to be curious about to know a little bit more about who my correspondent was. And I'm always so impressed by the breadth of Mahyar's knowledge and reading. And I guess it's not so surprising since she spends all of her time in a library and also working for publishing houses. So, in fact, Mahyar, you're better read than I am, quite frankly. And I'll take your recommendations into consideration. But as you know, I've got a long list of guests to get around to. So, once again, I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. In addition, you can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site, and you can leave voicemail on our phone at 415-830-4014, or you can also leave voicemail using our dedicated standalone app, and you can find out more about that on the Apps tab on our site. Thanks to today's guest, Sarah Joy Marsh, for her insights into the therapeutic use of yoga for food disorders, addictions, trauma, and so on. My next interview will be with clinical social worker, psychotherapist, former journalist, and consummate seeker, Kim Schneiderman, author of the book, Step Out of Your Story. So I hope you will join us. And until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
Shrinkwrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.